today on Against the Grain. In the United States, few things seem as wholesome as camping, letting us temporarily escape the daily grind and commune with nature and each other. But Phoebe Young argues that camping has a complicated history, which tells us a lot about Americans' notions of nature and the nation. She discusses the various forms that camping has taken in this country, from recreational camping to Occupy Wall Street. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Camping in this country is a hallowed activity, as American as apple pie. But since nature enthusiasts first started camping in the late 19th century, great pains have been taken to distinguish such rusticating from hobo camps and today, homeless encampments. As historian Phoebe Young writes, that Americans have come to prize some forms and places for sleeping outside while marginalizing and criminalizing others, illustrates how camping embodies certain facets of ongoing national dilemmas. While recreational camping sometimes masquerades as universal, the one form of camping that is without politics, it too arose from a specific outlook and moment in American history. She explores that history in Camping Ground, Public Nature in American Life, from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. Phoebe, how would you define camping, and why do you group what we might call recreational camping with the overnight political occupation of space, like Occupy, and those who camp because they are without shelter?
So I lump them all under this label of camping because they are in some ways practicing the same kinds of activities, right? Of setting up a tent and sleeping outside at kind of the most elemental. Obviously, the circumstances that bring people to do those things are wildly different. And so what we get from thinking about these three different categories, if you will, of camping in the same space is to see how they evolved in conversation, in tension with each other. And the ways in which why we think of camping, what automatically springs to mind when someone says camping is recreational, the recreational version, there's a history there, and that wasn't always the case, and that recreational camping in many ways began to define itself, or the sort of recreational campers, as pushing back against particularly those who camped for functional reasons in an earlier period. And so how we think about what recreational camping means, we really can't disentangle it from the other forms.
Well, we'll be talking about a whole range of issues as they come across time, but I wanted to sort of begin at the beginning, at least for the United States, and ask you about how, at its outset, the creation or dispossession and enclosure of land, of agricultural property, was a key aspect of the foundation of the United States as a nation. Can you tell us about that history?
Absolutely. So it's baked into the sort of social contract, right, in the founding of the United States. And so going back to John Locke and Thomas Jefferson, talking about how the fundamental piece of sort of founding the nation and of the relationship between government and citizens was about property. And the formula for making your own property was to mix your labor with the land, right? To claim a piece of land, to work it, to farm it, and then it becomes your property, right? And according to Jefferson and other founders, this was the route to virtuous citizenship, right? And the basis of the republic, that government's job was to protect that property, to make available more potential property by expanding, by dispossessing indigenous people, creating more land available to claim in that way. And so that, for particularly the first century of the sort of since the founding of the United States, really was the kind of foundational way that people understood their relationship to the nation as a whole.
Can you describe for us the shift that took place in the United States as it moved from being a primarily agrarian society to a more urban, industrialized society. And the kind of reaction that created in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Sure. So that sort of agrarian dream, right, that was based in mixing your labor with the land, was, not available to all from the very beginning, obviously, to gain their own property, but it became over time even less and less possible for many Americans to, be able to make a sustainable life through agriculture. And more moved to the cities, took jobs in factories, or came to the United States from other countries and concentrated in urban areas. And so this kind of deep connection to the land began to make some Americans anxious. That became less possible, right? That it was not part, it was part of their kind of the background, but living in the cities, working in the office, you didn't have that connection. And so, among many different reactions to that kind of epical transformation towards an industrial economy, was that people began to seek out the land in different ways. Maybe not to own it, not to work it, but to instead mix their leisure with the land and reconnect in that way.
So tell us how that looked in the late 19th century. Tell us about the first wave of people who did what we would understand now as recreational camping and the social context in which that took place, as well as who we're talking about.
Really, I look at the first wave of many of what we might think of as recreational campers as Civil War veterans, but they're kind of a different case. So I might save them for later in ways in which they kind of mixed recreational with political forms. But in terms of this shift of those folks in the living in the cities who were seeking a reconnection with the land in the late 19th century, absolutely. So these are largely elite, definitely. Nearly entirely white Americans who have leisure time. So in the late 19th century, most working class folks, might get one day off per week and don't have a lot of leisure time or disposable income to spend on leisure activities. So it's really more this upper echelon that we're talking about who have both the time and the money to experiment with these different ways of taking a break, of getting out of the city and reconnecting with the land. Because camping at that time took an inordinate amount of effort. There were not kind of regulated campgrounds where you could expect a certain level of infrastructure waiting for you. You sort of had to go out and find your own space and bring everything with you. And so we see elite Americans, right, that sort of Teddy Roosevelt is kind of a if you want to attach a name to that set, you can think of those kind of upper crust East Coasters wanting to venture out and kind of find their space out in the great outdoors and kind of rejuvenate themselves in a variety of ways in this kind of late 19th, early 20th century moment. And so that's really what they were seeking in lots of ways to do. And that's the kind of broader social context. Now, the one of the things that's also happening at this time is that the economy is in these wild boom and bust cycles. And so workers, particularly, get caught in those downturns. And there's a lot of unemployment. And you see a number of folks joining the ranks of what were called tramps at the time. So mobile, sort of migrant Americans, some looking for work, others just trying to ride out the economic storm, that are camping for functional reasons. They are in a variety of kinds of spaces, causing alarm for many Americans about what this kind of rootlessness meant for the nation. This was, seen as the tramp problem. So you've got these elite, recreational campers out there, playing in nature. And then you have these folks who are just trying to kind of make it and using camping as a kind of rational strategy during an economic downturn. And recreational campers in particular want to distance themselves and make sure people don't mistake them for tramps. So, right at the beginning, this idea of recreational camping has built into it this attempt to differentiate itself, right, from those who are camping for other kinds of reasons, that it's really from the get-go that division shows up.
So interesting how that, of course, remains to this day. Let me ask you about the environmentalist and conservationist John Muir of Sierra Club fame. What shaped his idea of wilderness itself, a very contested notion, right, of uninhabited space? And how did he, in turn, influence how Americans saw it as it relates to camping?
John Muir, who we tend to know, right, from the moment in which he's kind of proclaiming the glories of the Sierra, is, you know, he's got a kind of backstory as to how he gets to that particular vision. And so his early travels in the immediate aftermath of the post-Civil War South, he takes this 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf Coast in 1867, and he's kind of ambivalent. He is enthralled with the idea of nature and will do many, you know, go through many hoops to observe and be part of it, but he hadn't yet quite come to this sense of immersing yourself in a leisured way was a sort of balm, right? Or that this was something that was spiritually healing. He loved being in nature, but he liked sleeping inside. He did not particularly like camping out, that he'd much prefer to sort of stay on somebody's stranger's floor or in their hayloft than to camp out on his own. But he gets to the Sierras and he starts to develop a different kind of outlook. And partly this comes through his travels in the South and encounters with African-American freed people, as well as indigenous folks in the Yosemite region. And he looks at the way they are camping and the sort of functional versions of these sort of, you know, displaced former enslaved people, and finds it that there's something not quite civilized, in his words, to it, that it's sort of too much out of necessity. And in a similar way, looking at Awanichi or other indigenous people in the Sierras, to see, he sees their interdependence. He sees them, at least partly, how they are living off the land, and knowing deeply the horticulture of the region. But he's not attracted to doing that. He sort of disdains it. He says, I should learn how to boil lupin and eat saxifrage and make acorn bread like the Indians, but he doesn't do that. He comes to this feeling of being the best way to experience nature is to kind of be apart from it, to be an ascetic. He's famous for kind of heading out into the Sierras with kind of a moldy hunk of cheese and maybe half a loaf of bread and maybe a blanket, but really no equipment or ability to make his own food. And he just kind of wanders in this state and believes that that kind of independence from nature makes him the best observer, the best able to kind of commune with the land. And so that, again, you see this sort of love of being in nature, but also this attempt to distance oneself from other versions, non kind of leisure versions of engaging with nature. And so it's this view that he begins to promote to many people, to, you know, his famous quotes, you know, going to the mountains is going home. And believing that what many, you know, nerve-stricken, overwrought, over-civilized people, in his words, need is this tonic of nature. And by that, he means by just being able to be in it for recreational reasons. Now, he has some issues with tourists who just want to hit the highlights and then head back. He wants people to really be in nature and appreciate it. But that he also doesn't want people to kind of engage and interact with the land in the same way that indigenous folks do. And so in the late 19th century, that's kind of the view that people get kind of really attached to in the origins of both the Sierra Club and the early preservationist movement becomes seen as kind of the highest use, right? That using nature for any kind of sort of functional reasons, whether that's sleeping for functional reasons outside, or grazing sheep, or other forms of extraction of nature, that becomes like the enemy, right, among preservationists. And so that's kind of how this vision gets more popularized. Now, I will, just a caveat, I mean, later in his life, Muir does develop more appreciation and understanding of indigenous lifeways, but particularly in this kind of 1870s, 1880s, 1890s era, when he's first kind of rising to fame and people are following him, he's definitely pushed back against those versions.
And we'll return to this whole idea, this lingering idea of nature as this transcendent experience, but I should say that I'm speaking with historian Phoebe Young about her book, Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life, From the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. That's published by Oxford University Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wanted to ask you about the aftermath of the Civil War, a time where, you know, you've just been describing John Muir in that era and his wanderings, but perhaps surprising to many, you date the emergence of one version of what we might think of as camping, or at least a complicated version of it, to those who are Civil War veterans. Tell us about that.
So, and I mostly speak about Union veterans in this case for reasons that I'll explain, but in the Civil War, masses of men, right, hundreds of thousands of men volunteer or are conscripted into the army and have these army camping experiences that are anything but recreational, for sure. But in the aftermath, right, in the years after the war, Union veterans in particular begin to kind of process their memories of the war, and camp, being in camp and kind of the anecdotes of that camp life, of the friendship, the camaraderie made within those camps, becomes a kind of safe place to remember the war and to be able to not relive the kind of trauma or kind of bloody nature of it. There's certainly lots of battle stories and people are fascinated by those, but many veterans kind of gravitate towards camp life as a kind of fonder memory of the war itself. And so veterans organizations, particularly the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the largest organization for Union veterans, begins to help promote that particular memory, but also then to use it as a part of their lobbying campaign for veterans' pensions, that the federal government should reward veterans for their service. And this is a campaign that goes on for decades in the 1870s and 80s and 90s to continually press the federal government. And so these two things kind of get aligned, and the GAR holds these national encampments, as they call them. That's their kind of annual reunion. And veterans from all over the country would go to a different city, usually in the late summer, and their reunions would be held as camps. They would set up army surplus tents and mass fields, and veterans would camp out, and in a way, reminding the public, and in some cases themselves, right, of the boys that won the war, that they were the ones who saved the Union. And so this becomes a vehicle both for kind of reunion, rejoining with friends, of kind of reconstituting a sense of community, which was much more a part of what they were doing about camping than escaping to nature. The sort of camp and the sort of backdrop of nature was the platform for doing that. But it was really the community that they were after and those kind of social relations.
So you said that there was a shift in the early 20th century from a view where in the United States of blending one's labor with nature to blending one's leisure with nature. That is, that there was the rise of a consumer culture of camping. Can you tell us what that looked like and the role of the government in fostering that kind of culture of camping?
In this kind of now early 20th century moment, you have this argument being advanced, right? That in a way, the mixing is the highest use. And it's certainly the sort of leisure and consumer economy is where the U.S. economy is headed. in the early 20th century. It's not quite there yet in 1900, but it certainly gets there over the next couple of decades. And what you see in the 1920s with the arrival of the Model T automobile and sort of growing automobile ownership that is available to the middle classes, various forms of travel and outdoor leisure explode in popularity and move outside of just the upper class and to be more widespread. And so what you see in the 1920s is, in a way, eerily a sort of precedent of things we see today, which is that the public lands begin to be overrun. And you see, right, the early set-asides that the federal government and states have made for forests and parks, right, for both preservation as well as outdoor recreation, begin to just be inundated by tourists and campers who want to use this space. And they're kind of running roughshod over the land, nailing their tent stakes to the roots of the sequoia trees, among other things. And so this belief that this kind of leisure becomes seen as a right, right? That Americans have the right to access these lands to have their kind of recreational connection with the outdoors. And you see as well, alongside this, a rapidly developing consumer market. It's not just the automobile, but all of the accessories, right, that you want to bring with you into camp. And so you look at these early magazines, you know, from the 1920s, Popular Mechanics and others are telling people, go buy this gear or go build this, you know, add on to your car to sort of make the camping experience more enjoyable. And so those start to merge. But the sort of deeper belief is much more about this leisure experience. And even though we might think about that as not consumer per se, you may not be buying anything to do that, but that sort of using leisure as a way of connecting with the land becomes not just sort of a vision by some as a highest use, but becomes by the 1930s, in fact, sponsored and subsidized by federal and state governments who look at this and see that they needed to provide infrastructure for these campers, in part to protect the lands, to try to minimize the impact upon the land, but also as a way of kind of offering a different version of that social contract, right? Of saying that the government's job is to provide this land, to allow people to have this opportunity to, you know, have outdoor leisure, and that is a version, a sort of modern version of experiencing your citizenship, your belonging to the nation. So this fellow, Emilio Meineke, which we can talk more about as a Californian, who designed the Loop Campground. Basically, every campground you've ever been to that has, you know, Loop A that, you know, takes you to Site 112 there. He designed this campground in the early 1930s. And his belief was that what people were doing there was in part claiming a share. He said that they had the rightful choice to claim 130 millionth part ownership of the land, and 130 million being the population at the time. And so he's really making this a kind of analogy to that earlier version of claiming your own property by mixing labor with the land. Here he's saying this is a way of claiming part ownership of the nation itself by camping. And so it's that philosophy that really begins to drive the expansion of campground infrastructure across the country in the 1930s and in subsequent decades.
Right. So you have, on the one hand, this idea of camping and, by extension, nature, the outdoors, as being something that really embodies what it is to be American or what the nation is. And then at the same time, the complicated role of others in seeing camping as playing a role that might be somewhat critical of modern American society. I wanted to ask you about recreational camping, especially leading up to the 60s, and the idea of camping as being tied in some way to a critique of American society and to the counterculture.
Yeah, so this form of camping in these loop campgrounds, right, that I talked about, the popularity of that grows even more in the 1950s, and becomes these campgrounds are packed with families with lots of young children. That's the baby boom time, right? And they become crowded and full of different kind of modern amenities in these campgrounds. And so some of those kids who grew up loving camping in this version with their family, but become kind of dissatisfied with what the campground is beginning to represent, a suburb in a way. It's a suburb out in the woods, and all of the sort of gear and materialistic aspect of the consumption of outdoor recreation that that it requires, and begin to see it as this reflection of mainstream society that we know, right, by the early 1960s, a significant subset of young Americans are seeing as problematic, and they feel alienated from that mainstream culture, and they're wanting to look for something that feels more authentic to them and a way of critiquing the kind of rapacious consumerist society that the United States had become. But they still liked the outdoors, right? But they wanted to sort of find a different way of connecting with it. And so what we call backpacking, right, had always existed alongside. I mean, you could call what John Muir did as backpacking, even though he carried very little with him. But that form of hiking and camping had always existed, but it was a pretty small slice of folks, particularly in the 1950s. So there were folks that weren't just sort of young people doing this. They didn't invent it, but they sort of began to appreciate what that might do, that they could literally walk away from that crowded loop campground and go find a sense of solitude and authenticity out in sort of more remote parts of the backcountry, right? And so they begin from that point of view and sort of a bit of a remove to critique not just the campground itself, but to think about the environment and what that rapacious consumer society was doing to these outdoor spaces and sort of degrading the environment, and to use backpacking as a way to both escape that feeling of being crowded in and kind of crunched into this kind of mainstream culture, and also to develop a whole new version of thinking about how to relate to nature and to the outdoors, that their belief of, this is the origins, right, of leave no trace, and of that sort of consciousness around the natural material as well as the sort of social organization that it might take to preserve it.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today, I'm joined by the author of Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement, which is published by Oxford University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Phoebe Young is Associate Professor of History at the University of Colorado Boulder. So Phoebe, I'd like to ask you about more overtly political camping, although it's very clear from your book and the arguments that you make that to separate out recreational camping as not political would be a mistake. You mentioned the camping of Civil War veterans. I wonder if you could tell us about more explicitly political camping in the 20th century during the Depression and then through to the Vietnam War.
Sure. So, and I appreciate, Sasha, you're noting that, right, even recreational camping has a politics to it, right? If you think about the federal government expanding this landscape for one set of leisure-seeking people, that there is clearly a vision of society that's built into that. But absolutely, we see examples of camping being used as an explicit political tool throughout this history. And it's arguably, as you say, started with Civil War veterans. We see it with the unemployed in the late 19th century. Those tramps, because some of them begin to organize, and it arguably had the first march on Washington in Coxey's Army, as they called it, in 1894. But probably the one that many people know best is what was called the Bonus Army, in 1932, in which a group of World War I veterans encamped in various sites around Washington, D.C., to try to pressure the federal government to grant their bonuses, these veterans' pensions, in a sense, early. They were not due to be paid until a decade or so later. And because of the sort of economic emergency, they were making the argument, as were many folks in Congress, that they should be paid this now rather than waiting. That ultimately failed that cause, but their camp out for weeks in Washington caused a national stir. People really paid attention to it. Some critiqued them for what they were doing and that it was just a kind of hobo jungle. Others felt that this was a very patriotic act that these veterans were doing to sort of press the case. Sort of public opinion was all over the map on that. But we know that it put a lot of pressure on the administration. And at that point, President Herbert Hoover's response kind of he bungled it in a way, and that people believed that he could have handled it better. And it was in part an ingredient that summer of 1932 in the disaffection with Hoover and the ultimate election of Franklin Roosevelt. So the camping itself, because of just the persistence and the longevity there, in lasting weeks, was partly what allowed that public opinion to kind of develop. And so we see that strategy replicated multiple times in the decades since, particularly in the 1960s and early 1970s. So, for example, in 1968, there is a six-week encampment on the Mall in Washington, D.C., called Resurrection City. Which was an aspect of the Poor People's Campaign, a campaign run through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Martin Luther King's organization, held really in the months in the wake of his assassination. And that this, again, we see folks, a multi-racial group of folks camped out for weeks at a time in the nation's capital, making the case that poverty needed to be higher on the administrative agenda. Again, it put pressure on the administration. And again, we see a kind of a heavy-handed eviction of the campers, the protesters, late in the game. Although at this point, a lot of the public opinion has turned against the protesters, probably not least because many were at, by this point feeling many white Americans were feeling over and done with the civil rights movement, and that this they just seemed to be making a mess of the Capitol, in the words of some of those who wrote in to the National Park Service. So again, it's this kind of camping, this long-term camping becomes provocative, right? That it's a way of bringing your protest up to the headlines. In ways that, you know, even Martin Luther King argued when he suggested that the Poor People's Campaign try an encampment approach. He said, you know, we need something more than a one-day march, just kind of a remarkable statement, right? After the momentous and memorable one-day march, right, in 1963, that by 1968, he felt we need to do something different. We need to make a lasting impression that we will not go away until their sort of protest is recognized. And so camping became the strategy for doing that. So that's the sort of that story. I mean, again, we see this happen. The Vietnam Veterans Against the War had the same kind of approach. They had a shorter camp out in 1971. But in their sort of big action that was led, this was the moment when John Kerry is making his statement to congressional committee, that they're camping out on the Mall, right at the sort of foot of the Capitol itself. And it's the same, make the same argument. Kerry makes the argument that this is really important, both symbolically and to just demonstrate the staying power of these protests. So it starts to gather steam at this time. And we see in the late 60s, early 70s, early 80s, a lot of these encamped protests.
Right. And of course, there was encampments with the divestment movement against apartheid in South Africa. And then, of course, most spectacularly, Occupy Wall Street, in which activists insisted they were not involved in recreational camping. But what was really striking about what they were doing was the overnight taking of space and, of course, usually urban space. How do you see Occupy Wall Street within this spectrum of political camping?
Yes, I mean, I think one of the, partly because it was a nationwide movement, right? I, in the book, focus on the movement in Washington, D.C., but that, yes, in city after city, you see this tactic being deployed of taking up space. And I think one of the things that I find so interesting about this is that it's, in part, while occupiers themselves were very clear to distinguish what they were doing from recreational camping, that in some ways they are still tapping into that formula that the designer of the Loop campground had proposed. They were claiming part ownership, right, of the nation, that by actually taking up that space, that land, it not only made their protest visible in a different way, and made it very provocative by claiming that space, that drove, you know, municipal campus officials to distraction to figure out what to do with them. But that also made a powerful claim on the nation that they were taking up this particular space and that they weren't going away, right? It was very tenacious in the way many Occupy encampments would get evicted and then rebuild, restake their tents, and doing that all through the fall of 2011, right? Coming up now on the 10th anniversary of Occupy. So I see Occupy as both within this long tradition of encamped protests, although the reaction of many at the time is that it felt unprecedented. I guess enough time had elapsed that memories were short enough. And we saw some pieces pop up saying, remember the bonus, army, remember Resurrection City, but that by and large, the public narrative treated this as it was completely new on the scene. But so part of what I see it as is a recent example of this long tradition. But I also think, I mean, what I see occupiers are sort of trying to do in that space was trying to model a different social organization, right? In ways that connected to those 1960s, 70s backpackers, right? That can we use this space as a way of experimenting with different models of living that was outside for them the, you know, kind of neoliberal capitalist order that had, you know, on the heels of the Great Recession, had thrown many people back on their heels, to say the least. And so I think partly it's both just the tactic and also what they tried to do with those spaces, as complex as they were. And as, you know, ultimately they did get shut down. But that, you know, the fact that Occupy, you know, made it to the halls of Congress and you see Congress people discussing with the head of the National Park Service, what is the definition of camping, suggested to me that they were doing something that was confounding expectations. They were mixing those categories of, you know, we see recreational camping as the sort of mainstream, wholesome, approved way to camp. And then you have these other marginalized versions, right? The functional camping of unsheltered people and this kind of overt political claiming of space through camping. And Occupy sort of came and messed up those boundaries and people had a hard time sort of figuring that out, which I think played into the fascination with what are they doing in those squares?
Indeed. And I should say that I'm speaking with historian Phoebe Young about her book, Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And while we haven't talked in as much detail about the third form of camping that you write about in your book, which is functional camping, that is, people who are without shelter, camping outside to survive, Occupy Wall Street, of course, melded in many cases that tradition of political camping that you were talking about that dates back through the Depression and earlier into the 19th century, and then also the situation of people who are without shelter.
Absolutely, right? So, we see this early, you know, with the tramps that I spoke about. We see this in the Depression, not just with those protesting, but migrants like those, you know, escaping the Dust Bowl or other out-of-work people living in Hoovervilles. And then, you know, really, I think we see it much more in sort of more recent decades, really since the 1980s, with the rise of sort of crises in unsheltered, more, you know, growing numbers of people without shelter. And there's, you know, obviously there's a lot of scholarship on what caused that uptick in the 1980s, and there are multiple factors with that. One interesting, another melding of these things happened as an encamped protest in Washington, D.C. in the early 80s around the issue of homelessness. And it what it did was it created both a functional space for individuals experiencing homelessness to live, but was also an explicit protest against the policies of that administration. It was called Reaganville. Was the protest in 1981. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court about whether this kind of protest was allowed, with a kind of really interesting history about, well, where does the line of what functional camping ends and political camping begins? And you see the justices sort of wrestling with this particular question, some of whom are saying, you know, there can't be any political message for sleeping. You can't have sort of political sleeping. But then you see Justice Thurgood Marshall say, well, if sitting at a segregated lunch counter or standing in a segregated library can express protest, then so too can sleeping become, he called it, a monument of protest. And so suggested that again, these things are still intertwined. But of course, we see them often very separately, that what unsheltered people are doing in urban spaces seems entirely different, right, from what people are doing either in political protest or recreation. And we treat them that way. And I think that it's interesting how those divisions have become so hardened, and that people's reactions to unsheltered people using these spaces is often rendered as a misuse of space, that space is supposed to be for recreation. You saw that even in that Supreme Court decision from 1984, where one of the other justices said, you know, people come to DC and they want to see a pleasant green space. They don't want to see unsheltered people camping there, right? So those kinds of divisions over what does it mean to have people occupying this space for reasons of necessity has, you know, that debate has been going on for a long time and continues today.
I wanted to ask you about how people, especially those who are critical of American society, you know, often from the left or progressives, may have lost sight of the long historical roots of a lot of these things in the way they see questions of camping and nature. On the one hand, you know, you were mentioning that with Occupy Wall Street, there was this sense of taking space in the context of neoliberal cities where a lot of public space had become smaller and smaller and smaller. And so an act of taking space and even prefiguring other ways of living, trying to think about other ways that people could live their lives beyond what we have now. On the other hand, it seems like those people who would be particularly critical of the status quo may have an unreflective view of nature, and camping is an extension of that, or backpacking is an extension of that, that left uninterrogated could be problematic. Is that something that you see? Are there contradictions here and any way of sort of teasing them apart?
Yeah, so I mean, this is a complicated landscape you've laid out here to navigate, but let me see if I can offer a couple of thoughts. I think, you know, with Occupy, you see different groups in different cities had kind of different relationships to, for example, the local unsheltered population, who sometimes were resentful of Occupy for somehow being allowed to stay in these spaces, even sort of less harassed by law enforcement than unsheltered people were, if that's right. And that's saying something. So there were sometimes difficult relationships, but other Occupy encampments also really opened their kitchens to unsheltered people and tried to make a sense of community there. So it really did become kind of complicated and variable depending on what city we're talking about. In whether they became, unsheltered people became kind of, well, that's not part of what we're trying to address, or whether they became sort of part of the movement itself. I do think, on the other hand, what you're saying is this sort of unreflective view of nature, of thinking of just going out into nature and preserving nature as this space for leisure and for people to kind of rejuvenate themselves. It creates relies upon the exclusions that have been built into the creation and use of those spaces for decades, right? So that to say that the kind of ideal is to go out into what appears to be, or an ideal is, an unpeopled space, to find that solitude and some sense of pristine nature, in order to understand that, you really have to avert your gaze from a much longer history of the creation of those spaces, the varied accessibility of those spaces to people of non-white, non-elite groups. And that absolutely, I think that leads in part to this division of seeing people who love to go outdoors and camp, but then see unsheltered people camping as causing environmental harm, among other things, right? Or preventing them from enjoying their spaces, right? And that who may very honestly want to support and ameliorate and try to address the problem of, very high housing costs, things that are driving higher rates of unsheltered populations in the cities. We want to solve that issue. That's not that they're sort of trying to obstruct that, but that somehow this notion of that they're camping gets in the way, right? And that they see that as an inappropriate response to being unsheltered. So in a way, I think trying to think more deeply about that longer history, about those contexts in which camping becomes a rational, if not first choice strategy for unsheltered people, and to see that as less the problem itself and more of a symptom of a much larger social issue that we're dealing with.
I'd like to end by asking you about the moment we're living in now. There's been a sharp increase in the already very high levels of people living without shelter during the COVID pandemic. At the same time, in the society at large, there now is sort of an evocation of the biological need to be in nature, such as the idea of forest bathing. How do you see our moment as it relates to this wider or longer view of camping in the United States?
So the pandemic is fascinating in the way it revealed some of these trends, and I spent last summer kind of rewriting the epilogue to include a number of these issues. And absolutely, I think, the rise in unsheltered folks preceding and during the pandemic is something we sort of really have to pay attention to. And I think one of the interesting things that we saw come out of it were some experiments with different ways of supporting these folks than we'd seen before, solutions that had been really resisted in the past. So, for example, safe sleeping villages, or just putting, making hotel space or apartment space available to unsheltered people at a high cost. But I think it will be interesting to see kind of how those experiments are evaluated now that they may be winding down on a number of levels, to see whether some of these might provide different openings for thinking about this particular problem. But absolutely, I think it's such an irony that we have at the same time this expanding group of people without shelter, at the same time as we're seeing a rise in interest in thinking about nature, not just as a fun place for recreation, but that there is a biological need, that there's something universal that's built into our bodies and our genes to connect with nature. And sort of watching these two things at the same time over the past few years, to me, what I see is this incredible disconnect. Whereas if it's true that we have this biological need for nature, then why are not unsheltered people like the healthiest among us? Is living outside, right, is you know, exposure to the outdoors at a far greater rate than most of us stuck at home on our Zoom screens. But it's clear that this kind of argument around the biological need, it also has very much to do with leisure. It's built into the foundation, I think, or just the basic assumptions of a lot of that research, that it sort of rests upon this longer history of creating the idea of recreation in nature. And so some of the studies suggest that there's a max time that where you max out your benefits of being outside, and it's something like 200 minutes a week. Something like that, that it's like that's the ideal amount of time, which of course then excludes the people who work outside, as well as the people who miss live outside for most of their day. So I'm skeptical and of the biological need argument myself. I think to the extent that it works for individuals, and it works for me, going outside, taking a hike, helps me de-stress, brings my blood pressure down. But to assume that means it is therefore biologically universal is something that makes most historians uncomfortable. That there's at least as much history baked into that particular belief as there is biology, and to recognize that it's a differential. And that it really depends in part on how much you feel like you belong in that space. And if you feel not a sense of relaxation, but perhaps a sense of surveillance or danger, that it's not as likely that you're going to feel the kind of biological reward of relaxation and de-stressing in those spaces than some other people. And so my perspective is that we have to think a little bit more carefully about how that neurological or biological effect happens, and that it's not just a kind of trigger in our hormones per se, but that that's conditioned by the social context in which we're experiencing.
Phoebe Young, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very pleased to have been here.
Phoebe Young has been my guest. She's Associate Professor of History at the University of Colorado Boulder. We've been discussing her book, Camping Grounds, Public Nature in American Life from the Civil War to the Occupy Movement. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. And of course, you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.